we welcome honorable members who've stuck out to be with us today. Let me welcome the delegates from the Africa Institute and the rest of the people who are here and long time no see faces as well. Today we were supposed to have received a briefing from NECSA, the Nuclear Energy Corporation of South Africa, on two areas, an update on the security breaches, not only the latest one but even the earlier one, because it's a point of concern. And also we wanted to get an update on the pending retrenchments in view of the fact that the very government is preparing itself for the new nuclear field program, and obviously it would be of interest to know on what basis is NECSA going ahead with the retrenchments in that light. But unfortunately, the department has appealed to us to postpone that briefing until they are confidently ready for that. I'm very sorry for those who came specially for that item. But rest assured, it will be coming back in due course. We'll be working with the department for an appropriate date. Having said that, we do have then the Africa Institute of South Africa to take us through on they call investment flows and challenges, but to me it's investment trends and patterns. That would definitely include flows and challenges. But with apologies, I will maintain my broad and generic term, because every time I want us to handle investment, it should include, you know, almost everything. The initial target for this was to have had briefings on investment trends and patterns in our country, South Africa, in the continent, as well as globally. But unfortunately, we were not able to, once again, get the department to come on that. But of course, we would still be getting an explanation on this matter as to why it was even difficult for them to just come and brief us on investment trends in the country, because that's definitely their forte. And given that it will definitely not be the last time that we handle such an important topic, in future, I definitely undertake that we will do our best to bring in various, aspects so that they can be able to empower us and also to empower the rest of the public, the country as a whole, as to what's happening. It is important for us at this juncture in our country to have an understanding of these investment trends and patterns, not just generally in the energy sector, but even specifically renewable energy. We've got two windows that have gone through in the first phase. Now, we've just had an investor conference for the third window, and there's been quite a number of interesting issues coming out in articles, through the media, through the various stakeholders. If I can remind this meeting, our last energy stakeholders meeting, which took place in June, it was just doing an overview on the previous procurement. One of the issues that came out there was that business sector was appealing to the department to be more confident and start getting ambitious to increase the amount of electricity that's going to be procured through renewable energy. They said that in view of the number of applications as compared to what they are putting on the table. In fact, for example, the last application or the window, second window, let me say, the department was asking for applications to the amount of 1,000 plus megawatts. However, the applications that came in went to, was three times that. Surely that indicates that there is interest to invest in this sector. The same would be the case on the liquid fuels or the hydrocarbons. We have a number of things that are either outstanding or pending there, let alone the need to ensure security of supplies of strategic stocks. But the upgrading of the current refineries or existing refineries in order to comply with cleaner fuels requirements, Umthombo project as well. And just recently we had an update on the liquefied petroleum gas, and there is an indication as well there, whether one fix that formally or informally, that business would like to, in particular, get certainty in order to start rolling its sleeves and making firm commitments, or even just expressing its appetite to invest in this area. In view of the government's drive for on renewable or rural development, surely concomitant to that is also ensuring that there's what we want and call rural energy and sufficient and appropriate rural energy supply as well. So it would be also interesting to see the extent to which there is investment, interest in that area. Of course, there are a number of other areas that one can articulate well with the nuclear energy and things. But all I wanted honourable members to say, as we move along doing our work, whether it's oversight work, whether it's engaging with the public, whether it's even in engaging with other parliamentarians at the international level, whether it's facilitating cooperative government, we should also be both aware and mindful of the investment trends and patterns in these various sectors. I'm sure that will ensure that we are able to, add value to our work from an informed position. Having said that, and welcoming everyone once again, and I can see from the first slide that Africa Institute through Dr. Smelane has really armed itself more than adequate, which is very much welcome. Thanks very much for that. I can see you've got Standard Bank in full force. That's very helpful. And on that basis, I trust you'll be able to touch, on a number of other areas, not just the continent, because, as I say, even if this is just a debut, but this is going to be a journey that will punctuate our work from time to time. We will see how we space these updates. I'm sure with your advice as well, whether we do it on a six-monthly basis or whatever, so that we get regular updates on the investment trend, and even see how we improve the information, because we may just be looking at it from a business perspective for now, but it might be helpful even in future that we look at it from both public and private investment, because investment is investment in various forms. Enough for my preaching. Can I allow the committee secretary to give us apologies?
Thank you, Chairperson. The following apologies: Honorable Tinto, who's on sick leave; Honorable Khadebe, who has constituency commitments; and then apologies from Honorable Matibela, Maya Tula, and Honorable Selau. And then we've also received an apologies from the Minister of Energy, the Deputy Minister of Energy, and the Director General of the Department of Energy, Chair. Those are the apologies, Chair.
Thank you very much, but I'm still very much interested to get from the department in writing as to why were they unable to come, at least for this one on investment, because I think they were quite capable of sharing with us their experiences and observations on investment trends and patents, particularly as the department that's assigned to handle this area. Thanks very much. Once again, welcome Dr. Smilane and your team. If you could introduce the other gentlemen, and then you take us through your presentation. Thank you very much.
Honorable Chair and honorable members of Parliament, the members of the media, and the distinguished guests. It is an honor again for us to be invited to come and make this briefing, which we consider it very important, bearing in mind that the Africa Institute of South Africa is given a very, very broad mandate of monitoring and conducting research on Africa, and then thereafter brief and inform the South Africans as to what is happening in Africa and what kind of strategic positioning South Africa should take in terms of maintaining its presence on the African continent. It was on that mandate that, of course, we have been invited to come and do this briefing on the investment and investment trends on energy. Honorable members, broadly I can say that energy actually is a single most important factor which now starts to combine countries in Africa. Unlike in the past, where Africa was being closely associated with poverty, closely associated with the wars, and all those kind of activities that were pulling back development in Africa. So I would say that at this moment, where I can refer to as the energy transition period in Africa, the question that we need to ask ourselves is, who are the role players and what are kind of investment patterns that are emerging? Are the areas which I can refer to them as traditional areas of traditional sources of energy, which include, among others, hydrocarbons, or the emerging areas which include, among others, the renewable sources of energy, the major attractions of investment in Africa? Surely these are the kind of the questions and where we will be providing answers through our presentation. As I indicated, the mandate of the Africa Institute of South Africa is broad, so as are the expectations as such. So this one, this kind of presentation that we'll be making today, we find it a little bit tricky actually, because we are not that much directly involved in terms of investment and tracking the investment patterns. So as we decided to invite none other than the bank. The aim is to provide a real-time information, first-hand information, so that if there are some other extra questions which the members would feel that they would like to ask, then they can get immediate answers. And I feel honored that the Standard Bank actually grab the opportunity. By doing so, as a private institution, it not only demonstrated its commitment to South Africa, but it demonstrated that it is dedicated to serve South Africa and its public. And Standard Bank is one of the bigger institutions of South Africa that have made a decision to expand its footprints on the African continent. And because of that, they approached us, the Africa Institute of South Africa, to say, can we work together with them in terms of understanding the dynamics of development on Africa? So this is not just a relationship that has been forged for the purpose of this presentation, but it is a relationship which has been going on for a quiet time, honorable members, which also demonstrate how in South Africa it is imperative to forge linkages and relationships between the government institutions and the private sector. So in forming this team, I could brought none other than the so-called, probably I would say that well-informed individuals to form this team that will be doing these presentations. With me, I have Mr. Nicholas Green, who has just arrived late, and who is very sorry about that, and Mr. Tayo Mosia, also from the Standard Bank. We might be joined in by another member, which is Mr. Vumile Linganiso, and myself. Oh, he's already there. Oh, great. And then myself is Thokozani Semelane, coming from the Africa Institute of South Africa. So because of the limitations in terms of the information that the Africa Institute of South Africa have, the briefing will be led by the Standard Bank. So I would like to hand over to Mr. Mosia to take us through. Thank you, members.
Very much, Mr. Chair, and my colleague, Dr. Semelane, and a welcome to the members. We thank you again for the opportunity to do this presentation, and in the interest of time, Mr. Chair, I will delve immediately into it. I will be guided by you in terms of where I should pause to take some questions. So we are very open and flexible in terms of how we wish to deliver this. We will break the presentation into three key parts, which is demonstrated on on the next slide. I'll really just do a quick introduction to Standard Bank. I know it's very well known, but in terms of the perspective of what we're discussing here today, then I will ask my colleague, Mr. Green, who's next to me, to just talk a little bit on the hydrocarbons and biofuels and biomass, and I will come in at the end to deal with some of the nuclear and renewable energy items. I note in your opening address, Mr. Chair, the comments that you made around renewables and the success of the program and so forth. So we hope to be able to embellish upon that and reflect on that as we go through the presentation. In terms of timing, I understand we have 30 minutes, which I wish to confirm.
How much?
30.
Can be flexible, I think, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We thank you for that indulgence, Mr. Chair. As typical advisors and bankers, we have somewhat overlaid in our slides. So without further ado, I'd like to just start with a quick introduction. For those of you who may not be ultimately familiar with all the corporate aspects of Standard Bank, I'm sure you know the brand and you're very familiar with it, but this year we're celebrating 150 years of existence. We wish to be around for another 150 years and more.
You're also boasting you're older than the ancient.
And we are the largest bank in Africa, so we take our responsibility towards the continent in terms of the growth that is happening in the continent that my colleague Dr. Semelane was talking about very seriously, as we consider the bank, like all the other, all our other partners in the banking industry, or shall I say the other banks, let me not say the partners, but we all have a great responsibility. We have an extensive branch network, which is important in terms of access and making sure financial services reach everyone. The team that is here today is from the investment banking side of Standard Bank, together with my colleague Vumile, who is in the Cape Town side and is on the corporate banking side. So it's what we call the corporate and investment bank. Our focus, and the map on the right shows you our countries of presence. Our focus is very strongly on sub-Saharan Africa, and the bank is completely completely focused at being an African bank for and across Africa. Our market capitalization, as you know, depends on where the stock market is at a particular point in time, but that is a reasonably good average of about 176, 180 billion rand. So we're very proud of that growth. And there you see some of the areas where the bank has been successful in investment over the past 15, 20 years. Nigeria, very strong franchise there. Kenya, we've just opened in Angola, which we're very proud of. And we've recently opened in the latest member state of Africa, which is South Sudan. So, and the flags at the bottom reflect those areas. We are headquartered in Johannesburg, but we have very strong franchises for Central, for East, West, and South Africa. Without further ado, I'd like to hand over to my colleague, Mr. Green, to take us through the hydrocarbons, and we'll just run the thing here for you. Or do you wish to sit here?
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, again apologies for my slightly late arrival. To delve straight into it, the slide we're looking at now is a quick snapshot of oil and gas across the African continent. As you can see, over a 10-year period between 2000 and these are 2012 figures, there's been a huge growth. You know, we're looking at over 10% growth in world oil production as well as oil reserves. Historically, oil and gas activities were dominated in the north and the west of the continent, whereas now you can see on the the schematic on the right that East Africa has come to the fore with large discoveries and a lot of exploration. Accompanying this unprecedented growth in the upstream segments, the exploration and production, requires a similar expansion in downstream infrastructure regarding refineries, terminals, LNG potential, and as well as pipelines. Infrastructure is particularly important for when new production is landlocked. One of those cases is the Great Lake region in Uganda. As you can see by the bar graphs we're showing here, the amount of production has increased again over a 10-year period. Now, the split between production and consumption shows that the region is not utilizing the full extent of the resource that is available on the African continent. And international demand is putting pressure on Africa to increase this production level to assist with this, the increasing demand overseas. Now having a look at the gas infrastructure in the static region. Historically, the gas infrastructure has been relatively poor due to the fact that energy demands have been met by coal resources and imported hydrocarbons. There's additionally been limited historical gas discoveries, as well as a limited route to market. The most recent East African gas discoveries offer a game changer, which could be coupled with Namibian and Angolan pre-salt discoveries, as well as South African shale gas and coal bed methane. In terms of the discussion going forward, we've just listed some questions as to how we would approach the sector. You know, what will the gas be used for? How much of the gas will be used domestically, and how much will be exported internationally or regionally? And with that, what infrastructure needs to be put in place, how much capacity can be handled, as well as, very importantly, in terms of financing and investing in infrastructure, is what is the timeline and the time frame for project implementation. Now, implications for South Africa and neighboring countries. Further questions that need to be asked are, will South Africa become a gas-based economy? Will coastal diesel-fired plants be repowered? Is South Africa going to buy LNG, or is the LNG produced going to be exported to Asian or European markets? Is South Africa going to invest further into gas-to-liquid technology? And will Namibia use any of the anticipated and existing gas discoveries? The next four slides, we run four different scenarios for South Africa in terms of gas and the infrastructure associated with it. The first scenario showed here is highlighting West Coast gas. It includes some fields off the west coast of South Africa, as well as off the coast of Namibia. This scenario looks at what is the route to market for this gas and the gas that is available. And what we propose here is to do independent power producers, where gas is piped from the offshore field on land and then put into open cycle or closed cycle gas turbines to generate power for the country. The second scenario that we look at is East Coast gas, which is predominantly from Mozambique. This includes existing fields just north of Maputo in the Panda and Samani field, as well as the new discoveries that have been made in areas 1 and 4 of the coast by Anadarko and Eni. Currently, the total expected resource of gas available there is in the region of 77 to 112 TCF. To put this into perspective, the gas pipeline that you can see in the green on the slide, a resource of 3 TCF justified the capital expenditure on that infrastructure. So you can imagine what 77 to 112 TCF would be able to justify in terms of infrastructure built. Further north from Mozambique, we have Tanzania, which has also had recent gas discoveries of significant extent. In terms of how we would look to the route to market for such gas assets would be potential putting it into GTL plants and exporting, as well as servicing regional needs and demands. We could look at potential increased pipeline capacity to South Africa, as well as using the gas to generate liquefied natural gas and then exporting by ship to the Asian and European markets where the prices are good or highest, rather. The third scenario would be using this East Coast gas and shipping it into South Africa, into existing gas turbines, as well as repowering open cycle gas turbines and converting these to closed cycle gas turbines. Additionally, the quantum of the gas available would justify new CCGT plants to be built. And potentially, should the demand be great enough, it could justify a pipeline from the east from Mozambique into South Africa, as opposed to just purchasing LNG and regasifying it when it lands on South African shores. The fourth scenario which we look at is shale gas. Now, the US EIA estimates 485 TCF of shale gas potential in South Africa. The full extent of that would not necessarily be economically viable to extract, but we can estimate that we have about 100 TCF of potential from shale gas. The use of this gas could be used to go to existing infrastructure like the Secunda GTL plant to turn into liquids. Alternatively, to use as a feedstock to existing and potentially new gas turbines, as well as sending it through to the Mossel Bay GTL plant, which is currently potentially running out of a feedstock in order to generate liquids. All of these scenarios combined require significant investments in infrastructure, be it in pipelines, in ports, as well as the actual, if it's power generation plants, the actual turbines themselves and the generation units. Moving on from gas resources, this is just a quick overview of the LPG market in South Africa, highlighting the current supply infrastructure as well as future potential LPG production. Currently, the domestic supply of LPG is produced at local refineries. As it's been widely publicized in the media, refinery capacity is constrained within South Africa at present, thus negatively affecting LPG production and delays to market. This results in overall production being low and falls short of the current demand that is present. That said, that's a South African example. Globally, there's actually a surplus of LPG where local demands our local demand outstrips local supply. South African LPG suppliers were particularly constrained due to the lack of sufficient import capacity for the product. Generally, because we don't have an LPG-based economy, or it's not hasn't historically been very popular, it's considered costly and time-ious to build infrastructure associated with the import of it. We therefore import a lot of the LPG to cover the shortfall, which is a strategic decision made by the Department of Energy. And current import infrastructure limits imports to 3,600 tons of LPG. The diagram that's available there just basically shows where the existing refineries are in South Africa and where the LPG is generated, as well as import and storage terminals across the country. In terms of increasing LPG supply within South Africa to meet the growing demand and thus making South Africa less dependent on importing LPG, the proposed Ibabasi project off the west coast of South Africa would have an associated gas processing facility, would be able to produce LPG and condensate in their refining process. The gas processing facility would be able to sell LPG under DOE regulations to the market. The increased local supply will decrease domestic dependency on LPG imports, as well as at the same time increasing our security of supply. This additional generation LPG generation capacity would enable the DOE to reach its LPG conversion targets with the current LPG infrastructure and refinery constraints that are in place. One of the byproducts of the gas refining process is not only LPG but the condensate that's produced, and this can be transported to offtakers countrywide, either by road, rail, or to be utilised in industry in various different applications. The pricing of condensate is extremely high in terms of the actual volume that you generate. So being able to produce additional condensate within the country would be highly beneficial. Moving further afield,
what's a condensate?
It's a byproduct that's generated in the gas refining process, which is then used in industrial applications. It could be used in the chemical processes, as an example, chemical manufacturing processes, as well as plastics. Moving further afield into East Africa. I touched on this earlier by mentioning the large gas discoveries off the coast of Mozambique in areas 1 and 4. There's a lot of information on the slide, but basically what we want to show is that the African Lake region, as well as the east coast, the northern coast of Mozambique and the southern coast of Tanzania, in the last 2 years has had incredible incredible gas discoveries. Just looking at the north of Mozambique in areas 1 and 4, so those are the concession areas, where the two consortia led by Anadarko and Eni collectively have approximately 160 TCF discovered at the moment. Just to put into perspective, this 160 TCF on a global ranking places Mozambique at number 10 at the moment in terms of gas resources available. As I mentioned earlier, the 3.5 TCF proven reserves in the Pande and Somani fields justified investment of a pipeline from the region into Gauteng and then down to Secunda. The bar graph on the left highlights the unprecedented reserve growth. So basically in 2007, the resource that they had proven. At the time, we're sitting at about 10 TCF, and over the last 5 years, that has increased to 2011, it increased to 120 TCF on a PPP basis. Just to give it, basically PPP and PPP, it's just different levels of probability. So proven probability as opposed to your initial sort of exploratory wells that you drill. Over time, these get become certified, and that amount grows, and the probability of that amount of gas being available increases. Just to go back to the ranking table, the five highlighted in red countries all have LPG export potential. LPG is being considered in Mozambique due to the fact that the quantum of gas available far, far, far outstrips the local demand for gas and its byproducts. So in terms, if you want to benefit the most from that resource, the best thing for the country would be to sell it on an export basis. Now, in terms of LPG, Mozambique would be competing with the Russian Federation, Qatar, the US, and Australia in the global LPG export market. Now, the reason why we're looking at putting this huge extent of gas into LPG is based on the fact that there's so much ancillary infrastructure and economic growth that is associated with the development of LPG. LNG. In terms of industrial processes, in terms of different markets and sectors that LNG can influence, we've just highlighted a few of the benefits of LNG production and why we see it as the key to the future for countries with large gas resources. We've highlighted the fact that it can go into fertilizer plants, which results in enhanced agricultural output. It increases LNG revenue for the companies associated in those countries, as well as tax revenue for the government, resulting in enhanced social investments. It's potential to put it into petrochemical plants and methanol plants, resulting in enhanced industrial output. Feeding the LNG into gas-fired power plants, accelerating industrialization, increased access to electricity in the countries plant, as well as ancillary infrastructure that is associated with the LNG infrastructure that will be built. These include airport expansion, port construction, rail network expansion, and road improvements, all resulting in accelerated infrastructure for the region. In terms of timelines, the top one in terms of potential LNG and LNG plants in Mozambique. This was the sort of indicative timeline that was given to us by one of the consortia that are active in the region. They drilled their first well in March 2010, and they're continuing to drill just to firm up the numbers on their resources. All the planning will go ahead in terms of accessing finance, as well as concession agreements with the government, hoping to reach financial close in 2014, following which the actual infrastructure will be built itself, and the LNG trains, which are the actual liquefaction units that take the gas from its gaseous state into its liquid state, would be complete in, we estimate, 2018, and the second train coming online in 2020. In terms of South African shale gas, planning is well underway for shale gas in the country, and it's specifically mentioned in the new development plan that was released recently. Planning for the shale gas infrastructure, we proceed to go on a continuous basis as new resources come online. We can expect to see our first wellheads and power plants, associated power plants, potentially coming online in 2014, over the course of about 2016, following which new gas pipelines and potential new gas liquid plants coming online from 2016 onwards, as well as the closed cycle gas turbines coming around from 2015, 2016. This again is just indicative as where we sort of foresee the rollout of this infrastructure and timelines with us. Are there any questions at this stage based on gas before I move on to biomass and biofuels? Or should we just keep going until then?
Mr. Nicholson.
Sorry?
We'll fill questions at the end.
Okay. Moving on to biofuels and then biomass. This is just an overview of liquid biofuels and the potential within South Africa or in Africa at large. Looking at different feedstocks, covering maize, sugarcane, sorghum, and sugar beet, all having different calorific values and different challenges and opportunities associated with all of them. Historically, maize has been a very successful bioethanol feedstock in the US. It was initially banned in South Africa due to political challenge. And surplus crops were going to be produced purely for energy production as opposed to for food contribution. Then looking at sugarcane, this is an option that sugar companies are considering at the moment, estimating that 10% of fuel supply could be replaced by what the sugarcane industry can provide. Not only would it be providing increased bioethanol or increased liquid fuels for the country, but it could potentially add 110,000 jobs to our economy. One of the challenges with sugarcane is the high water requirement for new crops, and we know that water is a constrained resource going forward in South Africa. And sorghum and sugar beets. Research and development is ongoing in terms of sugar beets, whereas sorghum is looked at favorably because it's drought resistant and less water is required to grow the feedstock. And although this is previously cultivated and consumed as food, the demand for it is decreasing, so the food versus fuel debate is less critical with sorghum as a fuel stock. Moving in from bioethanol to biodiesel, it has a different set of feedstocks. These highlighted here would be sunflower seeds, soya beans, waste oil, and algae. Algae at the moment is still very much in a research and development stage. South Monroe University are looking into research as well as a lot of the big international oil companies, which are putting a lot of money behind their research as to see, is this going to be a viable feedstock for biodiesel, and how long will it take to get onto large-scale production? Waste oil is also being considered. It just comes down to availability and can you secure long-term supply of waste oil to meet the demands for the production of biodiesel. Soybeans. Unfortunately, local supply currently doesn't satisfy the demand required in order to produce the quantum that would be significant in biodiesel. So it then feeds into the fuel versus food debate. And sunflower seeds, sunflower meal, supply and parity with demand. So at the moment, the market can't actually absorb any more. We would need to have new production of this feedstock purely considered for biodiesel alone. In terms of investment considerations associated with biofuels, what's critical is the stable feedstock and the availability for an efficient manufacturing plant capacity. It would be a fairly new industry in South Africa, and the manufacturing plants and efficiency thereof needs to be considered at length. Plant costs differ depending on feedstock used. Again, it comes down to the debate we're facing in the renewables program, which is the how expensive is it and how soon can it come down the cost curve and when will it be feasible for us to be doing locally. Then there's associated infrastructure costs that come along with liquid biofuels. These, touching on a few, is the blending, the cost of actually blending the land, refinery upgrades required for the clean fuels policy, storage of the output, as well as transportation and the water associated water usage. And in terms of, you know, you actually produce the clean fuel or the biodiesel, the bioethanol, what impact is going to be made, how is the end user actually going to be impacted? Are they going to have to convert their existing motor vehicle and at what cost in order to use a fuel that's blended with bioethanol and biodiesel. In terms of government, there's currently regulatory framework and incentives. In terms of blending, the May 2012 Petroleum Products Act amendment allows the sale of low sulfur diesel with maximum biodiesel blends of 5%, 10%, 20%, 30%, and 50%. It just needs to be clearly labeled, and I think that's going to be a phased-in approach. There's also been government research support. I mentioned earlier, Sasol and Rhodes University are looking at doing more research into algal biofuel research. And the IDC plans to support projects to develop approximately 300 million litres per annum by 2016. Currently, pre-feasibility studies indicate capital cost of up to 5.1 billion rand in order to meet that 300 million litres per annum supply. And then there's been an announcement of investment in a 90 million litre per annum bioethanol plant from Sorghum, which will be located in Craddock, with construction commencing this year. Moving away from biofuels into biomass, this is an overview of two different feedstocks that are considered for biomass, being sugar and pulp. Pulp is a byproduct in the paper producing process, and this has been spurred on by the need to turn away from fossil fuels and look to more renewable resources, such as biomass and sugar bagasse. Many pulp and paper or sugar mills produce more than half of their own energy demands from the biomass fuels recovered from their ordinary production processes. And it is believed that the use of biomass for energy and fuel production will be limited by maximum production rates and supply of biomass rather than demand for energy and fuel. It's basically the amount that they can produce is limited by the amount of the paper and the amount of sugar that they produce. This just goes into more specifics of the actual production process, whereas typical pulp mills also have to eliminate the wood residues generated in the wood handling area, which basically consists of bark, sawdust, and fines from screening. This just gives you insight as to what the feedstock is actually going to be. It's not drawing away from the paper production, but rather using a byproduct of paper production to produce their own energy. These byproducts are then put into auxiliary boilers, and high-pressure steam from both recovery and auxiliary boilers are sent into generators to produce power. In terms of supply and demand of power, these companies often use the power for their own demand, but when they don't necessarily require the power, there's also potential for them to be feeding that excess power onto the grid where other off-takers can use it. Looking more specifically at sugar, sugar companies already use bagasse waste in their own production facilities, and it is a small extension to then take the waste product out and then put it into their own boilers and generate power, and again produce electricity that can then be sent to the grid. To put it into perspective, on a global scale, in Europe, biomass is a meaningful contributor to the energy mix, and we believe that the South African sugar and pulp and paper industries can provide a significant contribution to the South African electricity sector, thus reducing the demand on Eskom.
Thanks, Nick. It's probably worth mentioning at this point through the chair that even though we've used a fair number of South African examples, the dynamics that apply to how these technologies are harnessed and the challenges that exist in harnessing these technologies and the flows and the demand patterns do tend to hold across countries in Africa, and are very similar in that respect. And as I now go into the next few slides discussing nuclear energy and renewable energy, I would encourage the House to look at what we mentioned in terms of these challenges that may exist in the South African environment are exactly similar in a lot of ways to the challenges that would exist in the rest of the continent. So what are the challenges that we are seeing for African states nuclear financing. Largely, it's really just the novel aspect of nuclear power plants. There have been very few new plants for the past 30 years, other than in certain of those economies in the East. There tends to be very limited NPP construction capability, equipment manufacturing, and the fuel cycle. And even with the countries like in France that have a long history in NPP construction, there are still now design complexities that create construction delays and cost overruns. Examples like Flamanville come to mind. Generally, nuclear is a subject of great societal interest, and therefore the environmental and social impact assessment and public consultation and licensing from the regulator becomes quite a complex process. We also tend to find that nuclear power plants at performance stage would typically underperform the availability basis relative to initial promises, and along the way substantial trade-offs need to be made in terms of localization, the speed of construction, the cost of construction. One needs a supportive regulatory framework because of the cost of nuclear, and this again talks to cost-reflective tariffs and the impact on the consumer, and particularly the poor, as one gets the tariff structure to reflect the cost. And with the experience of recent events in the nuclear power plant is the whole black swan events and how to deal with these externalities that are very difficult to measure at inception and certainly very difficult to deal with at occurrence. From the financing side, very quickly, is the scale of it means that a large amount of debt is required. These plants are typically have a life of 60 years, so long debt tenors are often required, and they tend to be much longer than what commercial lenders can lend. Therefore, and quite frankly, a big driver of it is what we call IDC, interest during construction, due to the very long construction period, which can be on the good side 5 to 7 years, on the bad side a little bit longer than that. And a lot of the economies in Africa are just not able to swap. The foreign investors who are investing into it would typically come in hard currency and expect a hard currency return, which would imply a dollar tariff, which brings that foreign currency exposure. And therefore, they need to be able to swap this, and you need deep pools of liquidity, whether it's in South Africa or Egypt or anywhere around the continent. So there is a limitation on domestic currency funding pools, and also given the other competing priorities, which becomes obvious. Nick has spoken about shale gas and the potential for shale. And this applies across the other countries as well. I mean, if you look at Mozambique, if you look at Zambia with its hydro potential, Kenya, which is geothermal, which we'll talk about later on. Therefore, what then the state needs to be able to support this, and governments are overstretched, especially coming through that global financial crisis, or the balance sheet of the local utility, be it Eskom, be it Zesco, be it Tanesco, to raise funding off its own balance sheet. So there are substantial challenges, and at the end of the day, a lot of countries choose to have a country partnership with the provider of the potential nuclear technology and get some concessional funding out of in that way. The typical sources of funding on the left-hand side, you'll see the scale. I'm now on page slide 26, showing from the public sources down to the private sources. I'll quickly run through those without reading at them necessarily, but you can do it off the government budget, which becomes quite a burden on the government. The government can raise bonds, and if you're BBB+ rated like South Africa, foreign currency rating, you get preferential rates on government bonds. If you are sub-investment grade, it becomes more expensive for you. Government loan guarantees, such as happened in the U.S., and on the next slide we'll talk about some of the international precedent that we've seen. I've mentioned export currency, export credit agency, which is the way that the foreign governments or the foreign countries that are looking at exporting their technology would back it up. Infrastructure bonds are one such example, and like I mentioned earlier, for example, in South Africa, Eskom has raised significant number of bonds in foreign markets, and this type of program can be continued. Worthy to mention that nuclear would not qualify for carbon credits, as it does not fall under the UNFCC carbon offset eligibility rules. Some of the precedents that we've seen around the world, in the U.S., look, around the world there's been the issue of the renaissance of nuclear. Different countries have dealt with it differently in terms of the funding challenge. In the U.S., using the government loan guarantee to unlock private funding. In France, there's always been a very strong government role. And, of course, Kuberg in South Africa does have the relationship with EDF. In China, again, they've been able to use country partnerships that they have formed. So, for example, EDF is in a joint venture with the Chinese CGNPC, and on that basis, they've acquired the technology that allows them to be able to go out. But, of course, slightly different licensing and permitting challenges. South Korea is another such example, where they've actually also done very good localization programs. Abu Dhabi has just procured a single foreign partner with immense speed and efficiency to build their capability. And in the UK, where the nuclear renaissance has been discussed for a while, they're certainly looking at going PPPs to help fund this program. In South Africa, and I think in the rest of the continent, the key thing is going to be localization, so that we can build sustainable jobs and meet a varied number of objectives. One of those is the capability that we have within Kuberg and Nexa to build on what Nexa is currently doing in terms of research and commercialization and bring back some of that capacity and capability that's been lost with regards to the nuclear fuel cycle, and therefore seek more export markets that allow us to be able to export our jobs. The challenges, as usual, is that the nuclear island technology does need to be imported. We don't have the current scale of O&M that is required, and we need to build that up, and this applies across the region, and the pure engineering and technical capability that is required. I've mentioned the funding challenges, and I again like to point out interest during construction as a key cost that needs to be carried across. Those are just our thoughts in terms of the potential for nuclear in the region. I will speak very quickly with regards to renewable energy. This is an interest slide. As we know, the difference here between South Africa and the rest of the neighboring countries and within SADC, South Africa adopted, firstly made very strong commitments at COP15 in Copenhagen with regards to reducing our emissions profile as the 10th largest polluter in the world. And thereafter, the South African government launched a very vigorous program to procure nuclear, with the IRP 2010 being the kingpin against which the 20-year plan for generation capacity. We haven't seen the same extent with some of the other neighboring states. I think South Africa has been a learning point, not just for Africa, but really for the rest of the world in our assessment as to how this can be done. As these neighboring states start to get a program going, we expect a very similar scale, because the quality of the resource, be it wind or solar, in sub-Saharan Africa really lends itself to this. Some of the potential new energy generation locations, you see shale in purple in the middle, There's the solar PV opportunity in yellow across the Northern Cape, up to almost the Gauteng region. There's wind on the right-hand side, and nuclear that I've mentioned, the three sites that have been the subject of the EIA from Eskom from the nuclear one days. That's a summary of IRP, which you are very familiar with. The point here in terms of how we are looking at tariffs, and these are in nominal terms, is that the gray line at the top shows you where this is all about grid parity, and that these types of technologies such as solar and PV will become
if you could go along, bearing in mind you're checking to novices in some of these things, we don't know grid parity.
Yes.
You still have a lot of time. Don't rush that much.
Okay. Maybe let me just let Nick say a few words in terms of geothermal in Africa.
Basically, geothermal resources have been mainly historically been found in the Rift Valley area in Kenya, and going west towards the Rwandan border. There's an estimation there that the potential for geothermal in the Kenyan Rift Valley area is up to 2,000 megawatts. I've recently seen more subsequent reports that expect this number to grow to about 3,000 megawatts. Geothermal has quite a bit of a history in the Kenyan environment, where two wells were first drilled in the 50s, and this was followed by increased interest in the 70s. Currently, it has become a lot more cost feasible to do feasibility studies surrounding geothermal because the cost of technology has come down along the price curve, making it more accessible to the Kenyan government to pay for feasibility studies to be done to see what extent they can leverage off this geothermal capacity within their borders. Excuse me. Currently, geothermal power constitutes about 15% of Kenya's electrical power generation, and this is set to increase. They are currently looking at geothermal to meet 30% of their energy needs by 2030. Some people have an aggressive view that if they could meet 30% of their energy needs by 2020 or 2025. Recently, Rwanda has started geothermal energy drilling, or started doing the feasibility studies for it, and they've been trying to secure funding in order to do that. To do the exploratory drilling. Some of the challenges facing geothermal is the high upfront costs, with no certainty as to whether these can be. Whether how successful it will be. You can do a feasibility study that can cost a few hundred million dollars and have absolutely no guarantee that the geothermal resource that where you're drilling will be suitable to actually put up a geothermal plant. As well as the region itself doesn't necessarily have the practical skills needed to expand the industry and to actually run geothermal plants, and this is inhibiting the uptake of the technology as well as the growth of the technology in the region. Looking at South Africa and geothermal potential, historically South Africa hasn't looked at it, there's been no large-scale production of geothermal power due to the fact that we've had access to extremely cheap coal-based electricity. That coupled with the fact that, to give you an example, in Kenya, they look to drill a few hundred meters to access the thermal potential, whereas our geology is such that the heat is very, very deep and requires significant drilling. We're talking thousands of meters down, and currently the only people that are sort of looking at geothermal in South Africa are some of the mining houses, because they already have shafts going down 2-3 kilometers, and then they can tap into that heat as a sort of added extra that the fact that they've drilled so deep down. It's considered that applications in South Africa would likely be of a smaller nature, than the larger plants due to the depth and the access to other forms of electricity. Kenya focuses on geothermal because they have very good, really shallow geothermal resources and don't have the energy infrastructure that is present in South Africa. Rwanda is looking at it because they share similar sort of similar geology to Kenya. It's just a question now of getting access to finance to see whether they can not only do the test drilling, but to do the actual construction of power plants on top of the resources. And that's geothermal in Africa.
Thanks, Nick. Thanks, Chair. With the few extra minutes that we may just utilize, probably just some comments on some of the, alongside what Nick has spoken about with Kenya, what we are seeing in some of the other countries, Zambia, obviously a lot of generation projects which are carrying on there, focused on their hydro capability, such as the Kafue Gorge Lower, which is about 750 megawatts, which is an AU project which is being planned. This really just demonstrates, if you also have a look at what's happening in Mozambique, where they're looking at the hydro, such as in Pandangua, the gas, and new coal IPPs, which are driven by the gas the coal concessions that have been awarded to the mining houses, such as Vale. We're seeing a high degree of power generation, and when we speak to stakeholders, they are really highlighting the point that it's the transmission that is starting to become the real bottleneck. There seem to be more than enough power generation projects in the region. A lot of those you may find in a particular country, you've got 3, 4, 5, 6 particular projects. The amount of liquidity that is there cannot support that number of projects. The amount of capacity and human management time cannot support that number of projects, and therefore the need for an emphasis on transmission is going to become important. So we are watching what's happening in Mozambique with regards to the transmission line, CESU, STE, and the need to be able to bring those two projects to financial close together is a real test case for how in the region we can plan our projects to coincide with each other and therefore reduce typical project-to-project risk. So we're also seeing projects in Malawi, Mauritius, and Namibia, and I'd just like to emphasize the need for the super grid. With those comments, I think we'd like to bring our presentation to a close, and thank you for the opportunity to present to the honorable members of the Portfolio Committee. Thank you, Chair.
Nothing from the smeller.
Basically, nothing, as I said, that the presentation is composed of a team, but I think it's demonstrated the in-depth of research that went through so that we can provide you with the up-to-date information on investment and the investment patterns on energy in Africa. Thank you.
Okay,
thank you, Chair, and I must say I'm really excited by this presentation. I mean, I think this is precisely the kinds of discussions we need to be having about our energy future. Because I think that when we look at our energy plan, I mean, our current 20-year energy plan is very much situated about South Africa and our energy needs and what we're going to build here. Whereas, in fact, what we've seen is that the regional picture has changed immensely in the last 2 years. And that actually we should be looking to capitalize on the regional energy dynamics and actually broadening that out. So thank you for that. But what the unanswered question for me, though, I mean, I'm very excited about the gas presentation particularly and the huge finds that have been made of Mozambique and Tanzania and so on. The issue is, I mean, there's a couple of issues for me. I mean, the one is that clearly we need to build the infrastructure to be able to capitalize on that. The issue, though, is how do we secure some of that gas for our own needs, and at what price can we secure that? So I always come back to the benchmark of what will we be able to generate electricity per kilowatt hour utilizing gas, because to me that's got to be what we compare apples with apples with the whole time. So, I mean, have we got any sense of what's going to happen with the gas price? Will we be able to secure a large proportion of that gas that has been found? Or will these countries, because, I mean, these are obviously sovereign countries with their own particular interests. They're not necessarily interested in South Africa's development as such. They're interested in getting the best price for their particular resource. So, I mean, what I've heard, for instance, is that Japan will want to buy a lot of this gas. And so we are another competitor. How do we lock up some of that? Do we lock it up through a pipeline? And do we explore that with Mozambique, for instance? Or do we lock it up in terms of investing in an energy terminal? So how do we manage to actually utilize the stuff in South Africa and secure it for the long term? And at what price will that then come in at? The other issue, though, and you mentioned it right at the end, I was going to ask you about the transmission grid, because I think that this is something that we really need for the future. What kind of investments do we need to make into not only the Southern African grid, but also the East African grid, so that we can have one interconnected system all the way? What level of investment are we looking at to create such a grid? Because I think that we should also be exploring building some of these power plants in other African countries and utilizing some of that energy. I don't see why we should build it all year. And you mentioned hydro, but, I mean, you didn't mention the big hydro potential, which is, of course, Inga. And, I mean, this has always been talked about. And, of course, there's huge, you know, political issues around this. But, I mean, we are talking about 40,000 megawatts from the Grand Inga scheme. And apparently along the whole Congo Basin, it's about 100,000 megawatts potential. So, you know, into the future, it probably will be a long way into the future, but how long into the future? Well, what are we looking at? What needs to happen there to utilize some of that resource as well? I'll leave it there for now. I'm sure I have more questions later.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairperson, and also appreciate the presentation. There are a few things which are concerning. One is the shale gas issue, because it seems to be covered up. At one time, we discussed it as open, and all of a sudden, nothing's happening. Then today, I hear that there's progress. So we need to know what is really happening here, because eventually, when it comes to this committee, we'll have to explain. We can't just say yes or say nay for no reason. The gas situation, the problem as I see it is the transport. Is how are we going to take the gas from the West Coast, for example? We did the Mozambique to Sasol. That pipeline was guarded. They had an agreement because, yeah, as you should rightly say, that Mozambique couldn't utilize all that gas that was there. And I think they're shooting themselves in the foot. When they develop, they wish they hadn't sent it out. So other countries will also be feeling it that way, because they certainly will need that gas in the short time. But it's the cost. Will the turbines that will be put up, will they be at source, or will they be somewhere else? Because if it's not at source, then you've got to travel. You've got to cost. So that's it. The biofuels, I was impressed with the situation in Brazil, especially with biodiesel, and it was compulsory for all heavy trucks to use the diesel. So there was the market, so that is it. The only problem with biodiesel, it doesn't stay fresh for long. You've got to utilize it all the time. You can't store it for a very long time. So those are the things. I'm not sure whether I missed this. You didn't say much about ethanol, because there again, there's conversions which are required. And Brazil, again, they converted the whole car, the whole cylinder head, to accommodate the ethanol. And because ethanol is, it's not new. The sugarcane industry, maybe when I was young, we used to blend ethanol with ordinary petrol. So it is there. And only problem, you can't use it straight because of detonation. You cannot, you've got to blend it.
the other thing is that I see nuclear, I'm not going to even mention it because I know the answer. You just don't want to see it. Because maybe we'll need someone else to give us a presentation who's more neutral. Because, yeah. The renewable energy, the thermal, yeah, I think it's, I wish we had to go into this more because in my little mind, you have a lot of hot springs all over the show, and that's an indication that the heat is there. But the depth, again, is another problem. But all these things, the serious situation is the cost. What do we do about this? Because that's where coal will stay on. Although we know it's not environmentally friendly, we can't continue using it because the alternative to the cost. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lucas. On my side, let me also thank the Institute as well as Standard Bank for this presentation. It's very helpful because it will make us consider what we need to add even in future when we engage on investments in the energy sector. My first question is that you, in some of the gas infrastructure implications you referred to, you have a question that will South Africa invest in GTL? Now, I would like us to add on that, what do you mean? When you say South Africa, is it public South Africa or private South Africa? Because the government already has a better essay in it. So, that I ask with great interest, because also Pedro SA is keen to go even further on that in that sector, because it has the technology in any case. In terms of the gas reserves, there are countries that you refer to as being having the potential to export. Can you rehearse that? Because I see your Iran, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Venezuela, Nigeria, Iraq, countries which are well known with the large deposits of oil, not being part of the top-ranking export potential, you know, sort of tourism. What is it that inhibits them? And also these triple P's and one P and third P, can you rehearse that and link it to some of the countries there, if possible? Which ones have got higher potentials or lower potentials? In terms of benefits on the, in fact, not just on the LNG, but even generally, you've highlighted quite a number of interesting areas: fertilizer plants, revenue, methanol, and the rest. Are there any signs from the investor sector of a growing appetite to invest on those? Should there be? Because I say this at times, you find that even if there's a potential, you don't find interest in a certain area. In fact, let me link it to something which I was going to raise earlier, but let me raise it now. Next week on the 30th, we'll have the energy stakeholders meeting, and one of the issues that we want to check there is the, challenges on the renewable energy that are facing investors in terms of putting money there, and also certification of locally produced equipment for renewable energy. I trust and hope Standard Bank will be there. So I'm actually saying that you don't have to take for granted that there's a potential for investment and then investors just come in. We'll see next week, but I'm linking it with what I see here, that you have listed a number of things. And the question I have, does that mean that there is going to be investment coming in, or there is going to be appetite for that area? Liquid biofuels. I thought National Mandela University is also part of this community that's looking at research on microalgae in particular, aren't they? And you made reference to waste oil. Can you take us through that? You know, which what is waste oil and how does it produce the biodiesel? I see you question the economic sustainability of maize for energy production. It would be helpful if you could take us through that once again. Although you moved a bit fast, but I thought also you would take us through from a sort of a financial perspective when it comes to refinery upgrades for clean fuels policies, that's in page 22. Because I did raise that in my introductory remarks as well, the contentious issues. Not only would we like to hear that from SAFIA, but we would like to hear from your side as well. You may be one bank, but you're part of a community of banks, bank association, and the rest. An issue that's going to be on the table for some time and under spotlight too. Just adding to Ndate Lucas, yes, it's interesting that when you come to nuclear, your first area is to talk about challenges facing nuclear instead of giving us an overview first. You made reference to the renaissance of nuclear energy. Can you rehearse that? Which areas signal that there's a renaissance of nuclear energy? In page 28, you made reference to O&M. Maybe I lost concentration. What is O&M? What does that mean? Another area is about Nexa. You said Nexa's capacity is being reduced. In what way? You even made reference to the nuclear fuel cycle. One of the areas that we've been very, very keen to understand, even from anyone, is that with very little explanation, the department replaced the refit process with the IPP procurement program. What's your prognosis on that? Because some countries are still arguing very strongly for refit strategy. But we've seen ever since we started the procurement process last year, a very strong appetite from investors and developers. No, let me say developers in particular. I tried to persuade you to go a little bit more to town around grid parity, but you decided to run away. Unfortunately, I have to persuade you again. Take us through. It's a very interesting issue, particularly if it's in the context of articulating the rollout of the IRP. Thank you. Over to you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you to the honourable members for the very insightful questions. We have quite a few here. Nick and I will keep winking at each other to say, you take that one, I take this one. So we'll try and tag team as much as we can, Chair, to make sure we get through your questions with some fluency. I must apologize. I misheard you on your comment on grid parity, Chair. I interpreted, and perhaps my mind ran ahead of me, that you were saying the House is not novice at this, and therefore I'm rehashing what the House is familiar with, which is why I skipped on it, Chair. So it was
actually, I was saying the opposite.
It seems to me very much now that that is what you're saying. So perhaps let me start there. So as it was a leftover part of my presentation, and then we will then start with the questions from scratch and run through them. The graphic that you would have on the Standard Bank view of tariff evolution is informed by the Eskom MYPD application, which was now public, and I'll just assist my colleague in getting to the and the Eskom comments and press comments on MYPD3, which is not obviously finalized yet. So the graph in red and yellow, which are very prominent there, demonstrate, based on those two sources, MIPD2 and part of MIPD3, what the Standard Bank view of the tariff path in nominal terms. So quite often this is reflected in real terms, and in real terms the graph smooths out once the inflationary increases take place. Now, what we've done is to say, well, what will the consumer pay out of their pocket in that particular year? And it shows an increasing tariff as opposed to in real terms, it should be flatter. So that's the first thing to just mention about that. Then there's the introduction of carbon tax, which is coming up. And so we go from the yellow graph to the red graph for the inclusion of carbon tax at the rate that we've estimated using the Standard Bank House view to have an understanding of what the consumer is going to be paying. Then the gray line at the top is, you'll see it starts at around 1.65 on the left-hand side there. And that is where BD2 from the rebid, from the REI quadruple P, on solar PV was that was the average of the winning tariffs. So it shows that graph, we used to have it much higher, and it shows how it's really coming down. Then the purple graph is the cogen and the wood chips, which is at the bottom, taken from the cogeneration, the NERSA cogeneration paper from about 3 years ago, if my memory serves me right. But we expect that obviously is breaking through grid parity now, but we expect that when the RFP runs on cogen, you might see numbers slightly above that. The blue graph, what is it, Nick, again? Is it wind? Yeah. The blue graph just above the purple graph is wind. So that's very 89 cents per kilowatt hour, and that's demonstrating that we should be hitting grid parity by 2014 onward. So just to answer the other question, Chair, that you overlaid on top of this, is that the competitive process that was embarked upon has certainly seen benefits in terms of bird prices coming down. Now, is there a downside to that, potentially, if we look forward? What we're seeing is that investors are attracted by IRR that allows them to recover for the risk and the cost. And that the IRR...
You use IRR in your banking world, but not here.
Pardon, sincere. Internal rate of return. Sorry, we've used it too many times in that format. The internal rate of return, which is how somebody would assess the project, at the equity level, is declining quite substantially, which is where NERSA started the process a few years ago of saying, at what return can you attract investors to come into the country to start a new sector, a new industry, and for them to make adequate return while balancing the need for the power and the protection of the poor. And they came within a band which, if my memory serves me right, was about 15 to 17% nominal post-tax levered. And that is now starting to come down. If the prices keep on coming down, that return keeps on coming down, then the question becomes, at what point do the investors say, we're not getting that return that we not want and we'll go elsewhere? The second issue around the declining return is if an investor has got equity and has got the O&M, and Chair, I'll also now talk about that, and has got the EPC for the construction, the foreign investor may have a total cumulative internal rate of return from all these activities, which is clearly above the equity rate of return, and therefore it remains a profitable undertaking for them. The local South African investor, who might not have the O&M, which is the operations and maintenance, so the ability to run the plant over a number of years and therefore get a substantial return, even though I've got to qualify that the tender documents do ask for BE participation in the O&M company. Somebody who does not have those additional returns, like the EPC, which clearly the European and American and Asian investors have that capability, would then be limited predominantly to the equity return, and therefore might find the entire business becoming of limited attraction compared to the overall overseas investor. Yes. If you look on this graph again, the two that I have not mentioned, which I dither whether I should at all, but our estimation of where Kusile and Medupi come in, considering ongoing IDC interest during construction over a protracted construction period, etc., is that that is the type of cost in ZAR per kilowatt hour, which is probably above the rand in our estimation. So that sort of takes us through the grid parity paper. I'll then, with your kind permission, like to turn to the series of questions as they started. And I will let me make some comments first in terms of our assessment of what's happening with gas in Mozambique. And it is at some early stages in the sense that it's exploration. Now, the numbers that you have in terms of how much does it cost to really explore and develop those wells is a figure that is easily, well, let's say it's greater than the GDP of the country of Mozambique. And a figure of $20-22 billion is not something that would be too remiss. Therefore, the operators of those wells would be looking very much at how they recover that and recover and have a very clear path in terms of the offtake agreements that need to be signed. Clearly, Asia is a target. But if you look at Asia as a target, you've also got to be thinking, well, where else is LNG potentially? So what's going to be the shape of the market going forward? We believe that Asia is a good target, but there could potentially be a lot of other LNG from other countries that also target Asia as a target. And therefore, you could have this dynamic down the line where you've got an overemphasis on Asia, which starts to drive the price down. There is no, because everybody's at an early negotiation stage, there really is no answer right now on where prices are likely to be. And it's going to be one of these fast-moving dynamics as people get ready. So who gets ready first and what can they sign up, etc. So it's very difficult for us to make an estimation on that. Suffice to say the Asian price is easily about 5 or 6 times the price that you would get in the United States right now. What does South Africa need to do? The South African, if you look at the quantities that are in Mozambique and Tanzania, Mozambique in particular, they're very huge. South Africa would not be an overall consumer of all of that. We've got to position ourselves in terms of negotiating alongside with the Asians to be an off-taker of that LNG. But it comes at cost in terms of construction of the LNG infrastructure that is required. So, which is why I actually just brought out of my bag the PICC, the infrastructure plan, because with regards to not just LNG, but also with regards to shale, significant investment in infrastructure is required to be able to take advantage of both our domestic gas and the gas that needs to come in from these countries. Very quickly, in terms of transmission, we share the view, and we have spoken with the South African utility Eskom and public. And their public engagement processes from time to time that they allow banks and the market to engage with them, that a super grid over the sub-Saharan part of Africa is an absolute necessity so that we get away from the need for people to say it is a matter of social sovereign security that we've got to have our own gas plant right here. We, along with the needs to really form an economic community, a SADC, and give emphasis to SADC, we have to give the same emphasis to how we deal with power and enable and have an environment that enables cross-border PPAs that up till now have been very difficult. We're very encouraged by how South Africa through the IRP has looked to import of import gas, import hydro, import coal. And this ability to strike cross-border PPA is now starting, but that needs to be emphasized. In that, and then the investment for it has to be sought, and there are various investment sources from where that will come. So when it comes to Grand Inga, I didn't mention it, of course, 40 megawatts, that's the big mama. But you can see that across this entire region, there is more than enough generation capacity. We're going to have to prioritize which projects we believe are in the best interest of the region so that scarce capital and scarce human capacity can be applied efficiently to these projects. I'll hand over to my colleague Nick for some of his comments.
Just to add on to what Nicholas mentioned about the gas price and procurement, I think the biggest driver of the high gas prices in the east is based on the fact that Japan had to shut down a lot of their nuclear program, which became more reliant on LNG imports. And South Korea is the largest importer of LNG globally. I mean, their whole country has gas infrastructure connecting the whole country from residential areas to commercial areas. They've got two regasification terminals that literally send gas I agree with in Clive's comments in terms of it is early stages. You know, the consortium that are looking to, sorry, the consortia that are looking to get behind the proposed LNG plants, they do need to have a cost-reflective tariff for the gas. It's a huge amount of money, and if they can sell it at, call it, I don't know, $10 to the east, why would they consider selling it to us for less? It's also, we need to keep in mind, you know, the gas price in the States has hit rock bottom. I mean, people are talking about $2 gas there. So again, it's companies, I think, would also would be nervous to enter into long-term contracts at a medium price because they don't know what will happen in the future. Again, I mean, that's been the case with oil, it's the same sort of thing, but I think people are very nervous because they've never seen that sort of drop in a resource price with anticipated a sort of more consistent and a more sort of stable view on it. So I'm just going to go through this list of questions. In terms of the West Coast gas, she asked about location of turbines and, you know, why aren't we sort of making more use of West Coast gas? Current projects that are underway are looking to pipe gas to land to feed into gas turbines to generate electricity, as well as have associated gas or additional gas with it that will be used in the gas industry. What it comes down to is, if you're going to build transmission network from that gas turbine that you can put at the shore where the gas lands, or do you build a pipeline to send the gas somewhere? Do you send electricity somewhere? Do you send gas somewhere? Or do you do both? And I think each project has different, you know, it's in a different environment. It has different access routes or routes to markets. So these things all need to be considered when looking at developing projects. In terms of the geothermal comment that you had, I know we have springs with hot water, but in terms of what is considered a geothermal source, they look at temperatures of over 150 degrees Celsius up to about 300 degrees Celsius. And then there's also an interplay between if it's steam or is it water-based. And I don't know necessarily what the resources are in the hot spring areas in the Western Cape, for example. You can only assume that it's possibly not large enough to justify investment. But I do agree that these things should be looked into further. Honourable Chair, in terms of your biofuel questions, NMU absolutely could be doing research on algae-based biodiesel. The list submitted wasn't a comprehensive list. It was just we're trying to show that South Africa is engaging in this discussion and doing the research into potential for algae in biodiesel generation. You asked a question about waste oil. Waste oil is literally old, for example, cooking oil that can be repurposed into biodiesel. It's just another sort of fuel source or a feedstock for biodiesel. I mean, I've seen even in the media recently, cars that have been running on chip oil, as they sort of process it and then put it into a car and it can run as well. So that was just one of the feedstocks. Your question around... maize and surface crops for energy production being economically sustainable. This was a bullet point, and I should have explained better at the time. But is it economically sustainable in terms of, are we only using surplus maize or surplus crops that aren't being consumed as food and making producing bioethanol? And if that's the case, you're never sure of what that amount will be, the amount of surplus, because there's different growing patterns. You never know what your end production rate is going to be. And if you're producing a facility to manufacture bioethanol, and you don't know, and you can't guarantee the feedstock for that facility, you have to question, is it economically feasible or sustainable to actually do that without a guaranteed feedstock for that production facility? In terms of the question, sorry, I'm jumping around a bit between technologies and resources, but the question around the way that possible reserves are rated on a P, double P and triple P basis, it's just an inference around statistical probability. So for example, at a statistical probability of 10%, you can't guarantee how specific it's going to be, how specific or how accurate the numbers that you're going to give. And it just shows that with increased with increased certification, increased sort of delving down into the numbers and into the resource, you can then, with a greater level of assurance and certainty, more accurately predict the full extent of the resource that is available. So, for example, triple P, it's the most specific or most accurate that is available at the time, because you've done sort of more due diligence and there's a higher probability of that amount being there. In terms of ranking of the ranking list, and you inquired about Iran, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Nigeria. Could you just again refer to what it was that you?
I thought those also amongst those export potentials, because they've got huge reserves of crude oil.
Crude oil, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Any country with a huge gas resource could develop LNG and export. Mm-hmm. In terms of the Russian Federation, as an example, their gas resources are often more landlocked, so it requires additional and over a broader area. So it requires additional sort of more larger extent of infrastructure required in order to actually get the gas into one collective train, which is the process where you liquefy the gas to make it available for export. The countries mentioned for LNG export terminal have actually also either currently have projects underway or looking to develop LNG projects for export potential. So that is the reason why they were sort of highlighted, to show that with Mozambique's 160 TCF. Yes, they're ranked number 10 at the moment in terms of gas resources, but they're potentially ranked fourth in the world in terms of LNG resources.
Let me take a few, Nick. Catch your breath. On the question with regards, I think it was the honorable member. No, it wasn't honorable member Lucas, but there was a question on what's happening on shale. So yes, there was a lot of activity, silent activity. We of course rely very much on what we are picking up from public sources with regards to this. So if we have a look at the work that has come out of the National Development Plan, there is a clear statement that gas has to be or is recommended to become a greater future of the South African energy mix. When we listen to what the Minister of Energy mentioned last week on the 16th of August at the Bidders Conference on Renewable Energy, she made pronouncements with regards to consideration of a Section 34 determination for gas that would look at gas to power, and she issued that. So our read from both of these indicates that there is certainly more momentum on gas in the country. Now, if you then think, well, where are the gas sources? You do have Ibu Bezi, you've got Kudu on the west coast, you've got possible LNG on the East Coast, but that still has to go through transaction dynamics with regards to will we get it or will it go to Japan and Asia. Then what are you left with? You've got project, you know, you've got PetroSA with its own efforts to get gas reserves, but the big elephant in the room is left as shale in the middle. So so our sort of read based on these developments is that shale is something that government is likely to lift a moratorium on, which has been in place, and if that starts to happen, then we could see it in a period of time becoming a viable reality. However, we do acknowledge that there's a big infrastructure requirement that has to be in place sufficiently for all of this to become practical. Without that, you really have got issues there. Therefore, the role of e-gas and PetroSA is going to be important going forward. Then, just touching on another question which came through the chairperson with regards to gas to liquid. So, correct, I think that is better read as further investment in GTL, considering both the private sector through Sasol and the state through PetroSA do have this capability. So that point is well noted. Potential to export. We've spoken about PPP. Then the benefits. I think the chair asked for us to embellish a little bit on the benefits with regards to fertilizers, etc., and all the various gas byproducts. I'll let Nick add something here, but let me start by maybe addressing the more economic question to say, will there be investor appetite? And I think this tied a little bit to renewables as well. So the way we look at it is really to say everything has to be planned properly in terms of where is demand and what the price elasticity with regards to demand. So is the demand for fertilizer in the African continent, considering that there are often environmental challenges which are brought up? I mean, I haven't looked at the sort of fertilizer demand curve recently, but it has the last curve that I saw showed that there is increasing demand for fertilizer as agriculture continues to be a cornerstone of a lot of African economies, and therefore export potential does still exist. And probably I'll count on my wise colleague here.
I think I can add a little bit on that, in that the way we look at the various sources of energy nowadays, surely they have some direct socio-industrial impact, which derive from the byproducts of each and every source, and then these we need to view them as the triggers of industrial development. So there is a direct link between the energy evolution and the industrial development, which that on its own requires some strategic direction, which may come from the parliament itself or from the decision makers and the people who have to guide the direction. Normally, I used to say that the current state of energy transition actually is reflective of an emerging new socio-technical approach to economic development. Have we been able to grasp that and formulate policies that will guide the industrial development of the country or not? Because if you look at, let us take an example of Sasol with its Fischer-Tropsch process, a process that was South Africa inherited, which was just lying, not being used, and it converted in a way that there are quite a number of industrial activities that are just associated with this single process, which have made Sasol big as it is nowadays. So similar pattern is emerging, honourable members. Thank you.
All right. Moving forward from the energy stakeholder meeting for the 20th that the chairperson mentioned, was the issue of challenges on renewable energy. I think I touched a little bit on that earlier, facing renewable energy investors. But then the issue of the certification of equipment is an interesting one.
Leave that for next week.
Okay.
Let's just appetize everyone and leave that.
All right. I'll leave that for next week, and I look forward to the invitation to the 20th. Then the challenges on nuclear. The chair observed that we started by mentioning the challenges and not the opportunity. So nuclear is obviously a clear opportunity for any country that is looking at, one, reducing its emissions, two, developing baseload capability. But when we look at everything, you've got to really look at your grid carefully and what type of merit you need on the system. In South Africa, there is a great need for baseload, but there is an even dying need for mid-merit capability. That type of mid-merit capability is typically provided by gas, by a clear load-following capability. So gas can therefore work is highly versatile and allows one to be able to work across the merit spectrum. So nuclear is part of the IRP 2010 for 9.6 gigawatts, and there is general, there is a general renaissance which the chair wanted to question and ask, where is this renaissance? We measure it in terms of the number of new nuclear power reactors which are being planned, which have been announced as being planned, and are being built around the world. A lot of those are being developed in the eastern economies, but those eastern economies are still part of the world. So based on the pure number, we are seeing this revival, which has been temporarily halted by the unfortunate events in Japan that happened. And really the renaissance that we've seen, I suppose, if you look at it over a measurement period, it's not just what's happened in the past 2 or 3 years since Japan, but what's been happening in the past 10 years. And it's been an increasing number of announced and being built reactors. Aligned to that was a question around Nexa and the capacity. So the best way to really respond to that is to say South Africa did have certain capacity on the nuclear fuel cycle which has been lost over a number of years, and we as South Africans took the decision, of course, with regards to breaking down our nuclear used under the warheads, not necessarily nuclear power. But one of the areas that we see that NEXA would have a very strong interest in is when you look at the nuclear fuel cycle and what they can do in terms of grabbing that as part of the nuclear procurement program and using that to rebuild up their capacity. They currently play a very important role in terms of R&D and with regards to isotopes, which are used in the medical industry. Not being an expert on the isotopes market globally, but I would expect that there is potentially a slowing down either in demand and hence prices for isotopes, and therefore the ability to participate in the nuclear fuel cycle presents an opportunity for NEXA. I spoke refit, yes, Chair. You asked about refit versus rebid, which is another way that people describe the bidding process, versus the official word, which is the REI quadruple P. When we certainly have been engaged with this over a number of years and spoken to a lot of stakeholders at their invitation for banks to engage with them. Overall, I think judging by the demand and the interest, so we think the move towards a bidding process was beneficial for the country overall in terms of the prices at which we got the bids in, considering that they're still above the blended Eskom tariff, so we need grid parity. So we think it was a positive move to actually go this way based on the evidence before us. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable members, I'm sure we've had the first briefing of this kind, and just to re-emphasize what Honourable Kreni has said, that one of the areas that our eyes got opened to is the necessity for South Africa when it looks at its energy security in the context of you know, the region, the discoveries that are coming up, you know, whether it's all LNG in particular, because of the vast amounts, and also internally. And I am sure there's already a number of favorable, you know, factors for that. Amongst them is the regional power pool that's within SADC, and it's the first one that's formed. And also the infrastructure plan, obviously, which I'm sure the private sector is looking into with a keen eye. I must say, as I said, thanks very much for the presentation. And obviously, when we do a rejoinder on it, we'll be looking at even broader areas, because this is first of its kind, and I will definitely ensure, Honourable Freding, that the hydro comes in. I was very keen on it as well. It may not be, you know, much around what South Africa can tap on internally within the country, but we know regionally there's vast potential on that. And also, we are part of BRICS, and it would be helpful in future that when we handle this, we'll be, you know, looking at anything in that context. And we definitely will ensure that we invite other, you know, role players and stakeholders in future, such that we can be able to have a clearer picture, even in various other areas, technology in particular as well, because technology plays a very crucial role in terms of investment, as we have heard from Anetti and other briefings of the past, because it will definitely make an impact or influence, you know, that because if you have been to WTO, you know, technology is one of the issues that becomes a tricky and sticky thing during negotiations, as well as the climate change platform as well, you know, UNFCC, and all the COPs it comes in. But the list goes on, Honourable Members. But as for now, and I'm sure everyone can concur, it's good that we have a sense, and it moves along our journey when we get engaged in other areas, and even as we may also know that come next month, we'll be getting all the various forms of reports, the financial report, the operational report from the department, as well as from the various entities. So having an overview of this, the kind of and the amount of investments or the pace of investments, you know, in the energy sector, I trust it will be quite helpful for us. Next week, Tuesday, in the afternoon, not as indicated there in the morning, because in the morning we'll have a joint sitting, and I'm sure everyone will be there, because we'll be debating on our victory in the Olympics, you know, although we got 6 out of the promised 12 medals. So next week will be... The first area we'll be looking into is update on legislative process. I strongly maintain, Honourable Members, that although the department did present to us
their plan. Things are not working according to that, and we need to just be clear as to what exactly and when exactly or almost exactly will certain deals be presented. I mean, even this presentation is making reference to petroleum amendment, amendments to the Petroleum Act. Sitting here, I'm just as keen as you are as to when are we going to get that, because all of those amendments, we've been told that they are more than urgent. So we'll be, honorable members, keen to know, just to have an update on the legislative process, which and what bill will come at what time. And then we'll be, the department also will update us on its international activities, particularly on international bodies, international programs, as well as international agreements, a little bit more in detail. I'm aware that something was done earlier this year, but because we did not brief them properly, I think we missed a lot of information. So this time, I've highlighted a little bit in detail what we expect so that they can indicate to us. Because when it comes to energy, you don't handle energy just internally within the country. It has very, very significant international dimensions, hence inviting the department once again. And lastly, the energy stakeholders meeting on Thursday at 5 o'clock. We'll be looking at what I've already alluded to, that would like us to look at the challenges in terms of financing and certification of locally produced equipment. Just to behave about that, because we are, as it is indicated in the presentation, that we are closing this year, expecting even the third window to be concluded. So we just have to, along the way, to be clear as to whether some of the areas which might have a potential of slowing progress are adequately addressed, and we will use that. And as you know, for energy stakeholders meeting, they are open to everybody, and the last one was very much vibrant, and I hope this one next week will even be more vibrant. On that note, have a happy weekend for all those who will rest, but some of us, the little devils, will still be working. The meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.